Imagine paying $100,000 a year for an education where basically 70% of the students just automatically get an A,
Right.
where the admissions process actively hides its criteria. And, you know, speaking your mind in class might actually get you punished with just 30 seconds of dead staring silence.
Yeah, I mean, that is the reality of the modern elite American university right now.
It's wild. Welcome to this deep dive, everyone. Today we are looking at this foundational collapse happening in real time.
And it really explains why the American public is experiencing this this unprecedented collapse of trust in higher education. We're watching an institution that once projected absolute certainty, intellectual rigor, slowly fracture from the inside out.
Exactly. And our map for this journey today is a fascinating interview between political scientist Yasha Monk and David Bromwich.
Right, the Yale literature professor.
Yeah, he's been there since 1988. So he's had a front row seat to this evolution for decades.
Yeah.
And if you've ever wondered why trust in these ivy-covered institutions is plummeting, Bromwich points to four massive systemic failures. Let's just give you the signal right at the top so you know where we're going.
Yeah, the core takeaways.
Right. Number one, admissions are a black box. The holistic process is basically deliberately opaque. Number two, grades have lost their meaning. We're talking massive grade inflation that destroys the whole feedback loop.
Which is huge.
It really is. Number three, monoculture over diversity of thought. A lack of viewpoint diversity among faculty has bred a culture of fear. And number four, a forgotten core purpose. Universities have basically drifted from their core mission of transmitting knowledge through intellectual friction.
We're trying to be second homes now.
Exactly. So to understand this collapse in trust, we really have to start at the very beginning of a student's journey, the front door.
The admissions process.
Right. So make sense of this for me. Bromwich spends a lot of time dissecting this concept of holistic admissions.
Yeah, well, on the surface, the word holistic sounds, deeply human.
Right. It sounds great.
The pitch is that they aren't just reducing a teenager to a test score. They're looking at the whole person, their character, their background, that unique spark. But the reality of how this system operates is deliberately opaque. It's a black box.
Hold on, though. Isn't the whole point of that holistic approach, theoretically, to help the disadvantaged kids, like the ones who didn't go to elite prep schools and couldn't afford expensive SAT tutors?
I mean, theoretically, yes, but Bromwich points out the tragic irony of how this opacity actually plays out in practice. It's a kind of fake niceness.
Fake niceness.
Yeah, like take Yale's financial aid policy as a perfect example of this disconnect. Yale has an incredible endowment, right? And they actually offer completely free tuition, room, and board for families making under $200,000 a year.
Which is a life-changing opportunity.
Exactly. But the sticker price, the number published in the brochures and on the website, remains around $100,000 a year. Oh, I see. Which completely backfires. Because if you're a bright, highly capable kid from a lower income family, you look at that $100,000 price tag, you just assume you can't afford it.
Right.
And you don't even bother applying.
Exactly. The university wants to maintain its prestigious high-value sticker price so they don't explicitly broadcast that massive cutoff. Refusing to publish clear financial cutoffs or clear academic minimums because they don't want to, quote-unquote, discourage anyone, it actually wastes students' time.
It raises false hopes.
And deters the exact demographic it claims it wants to help.
It really is like a VIP club that refuses to post the entry fee or the dress code.
That's a great way to put it.
Like, meaning the only people who bother lining up are the ones who already know the bouncer or know how to perform the right vibe. Privilege just compounds in that kind of complex system.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Wealthy families have the resources to hire private consultants who know exactly what holistic buzzwords to weave into a personal statement.
Or they have the financial advisors who know how to front load a family business's losses into a specific tax year to artificially hit that financial aid threshold.
That's crazy. And the sources also highlight how this opacity historically serves to protect the institution, not the applicant,
Here.
like the personality scores used at Harvard.
Oh, yeah. The history there is incredibly dark.
It really is. Back in the 1920s, Harvard's administration basically realized that Jewish students were scoring incredibly high on academic entrance exams.
Taking up a larger percentage of the incoming class.
Exactly. So what did they do? They introduced these subjective character and personality scores specifically as a mechanism to cap Jewish enrollment.
Right.
And fast forward to recently, Data has shown that these exact same subjective personality scores heavily disadvantage Asian applicants.
Yeah, the data shows they're penalized by over a standard deviation compared to other groups.
Which, just looking at the math, is a massive, highly unusual drop that cannot just be chalked up to random chance. I mean, it implies a systemic cap.
It perfectly illustrates the danger of a black box system. When you remove objective, transparent criteria, human bias inevitably creeps in under the guise of holistic assessment.
We even see the resilience of this opaque system in the enrollment data, right after the Supreme Court's recent ban on affirmative action.
Right. Everyone predicted a massive demographic shift at places like Yale.
But black enrollment barely dropped. It moved only from 14% to 12%.
Yeah. For Bromwich, this indicates the system already had complex, invisible workarounds built into it to achieve its desired demographic outcomes, completely regardless of what the explicit legal rules dictated.
So what's the fix?
Well, Bromwich notes this really came to a head when universities went test optional during the pandemic. He actually observed a serious drop-off in the intellectual quality and preparedness of the students in his classrooms.
Really?
Yeah. So his recommendation is surprisingly simple. Set explicit minimum SAT thresholds and publish them.
Just strip away the illusion.
Exactly. Be honest about what it takes to get in the room so everyone is playing by the same transparent rules.
Okay, so if the front door is this highly gamed system pretending to be a pure meritocracy, what happens when a student successfully navigates that labyrinth and actually sits down in the classroom? You'd expect rigorous academic sorting, right?
You would hope so. You survive the gauntlet, you get into Yale, you expect the professors to push you to your absolute limits.
But instead, they face a completely different kind of illusion, a massive epidemic of grade inflation.
It's genuinely staggering. According to the data Bromwich discusses, roughly 70% of the grades given at Yale today are A's or A minuses.
70%.
70%. And it's really important to note, this isn't just happening in, you know, subjective humanities seminars where grading an essay can be kind of fluid. This 70% figure applies to the natural sciences and mathematics as well.
I mean, it's like playing a video game where every player gets the high score just for turning on the console.
Right.
Where's the motivation to actually learn the mechanics?
Exactly, because a grade is fundamentally a piece of information. It's a signal.
Right.
It's basically the only metric telling a student where they stand relative to the material and to their peers. So when 70% of the class gets an A, that signal is completely destroyed.
Right. The student literally cannot know how they're actually doing.
Exactly. It transforms an environment of learning, which fundamentally requires stumbling, failing, and course correcting into an environment of mere validation.
Which totally explains why students predictably start gravitating toward gut courses.
Oh, the easy classes.
Yeah, the ones where they know they can maintain a perfect GPA without breaking a sweat because the friction is just completely gone.
They're optimizing for the credential rather than the education.
So how do we fix the grades?
Bromwich's recommendation here is to make it easier to calibrate grades against the class cohort. He suggests forcing a distribution curve so that true academic distinction can actually show up on a transcript. Because right now, the absence of a meaningful grading signal is destroying the entire academic feedback loop.
Right. And if grades aren't providing that pushback or challenging the students, what kind of culture does that create on campus?
Well, it leads to our third point. A campus culture of intense conformity rather than intellectual clash.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The sources note a remarkable statistic regarding this culture. Upwards of 90% of faculty at these elite institutions are registered Democrats.
Right. Now, Bromwich is careful to clarify how he views this. He isn't suggesting this is some grand, deliberate plot to indoctrinate youth.
Right. And to be clear, we're just reporting Bromwich's analysis of the environment here.
Exactly. He views it simply as a deeply entrenched political monoculture.
Yeah.
The issue is that an environment where 90% of the authority figures lean heavily to one side, well, it drastically fails to reflect the reality of a nation that there's roughly split 51 to 49.
Right.
And he points out that what he terms the identitarian left, which is a focus heavily centered on group identity, has found a particularly strong foothold in this environment, specifically within gender, ethnic, and immigration studies programs.
And regardless of where anyone stands on the political spectrum, the core problem Bromwich identifies here is the massive chilling effect this monoculture creates.
Absolutely. Students and faculty naturally begin to fear expressing non-mainstream views.
And there's a specific anecdote from Bromwich's observations that is just genuinely unsettling.
Oh, the silence tactic.
Yes. He describes how some teachers respond to heterodox comments from students, basically any idea that challenges the accepted mainstream narrative of the class. Instead of debating the student, the professor responds with a punishing 30 seconds of dead silence.
I mean, just think about the psychological weight of that for a 19-year-old
student. 30 seconds of absolute silence in a room full of your peers.
And then the professor simply moves on without even addressing the idea. That tactic is infinitely more effective at shutting down debate than actually arguing with the student on the merits of their point.
It sends a chilling, undeniable message. That thought is not just factually wrong, it is socially unacceptable to even speak aloud.
Right. And it's a pipeline problem. You can't fix this hiring imbalance without using ideological litmus tests, which creates a standoff.
Because current faculty are the ones who hire new faculty. So an ideological imbalance naturally tends to replicate itself.
Exactly. One partial solution Bromwich suggests is creating special institutes or centers where diverse viewpoints can be taught outside of these quote-unquote captured departments.
But wait, if the faculty pipeline is already set, how exactly do these new independent centers survive without just being isolated from the rest of the student body? Won't they just become quarantined echo chambers?
That is a highly valid critique, and it points to just how deep the cultural entrenchment really goes. To understand the absolute peak of this conformity pressure, Bromwich points back to the 2015 and 2016 academic year.
Right, the Halloween moment at Yale.
The Christakis incident.
Yeah, this was a massive national story. Erica Christakis, who is a child development expert and a faculty in residence, sent an email to students regarding Halloween costumes.
Right, because the administration had sent out guidelines telling students what not to wear.
Exactly. Her email basically asked a philosophical question. Have we lost faith in young people's capacity to ignore or reject things they find offensive? She suggested that students should be free to wear what they wanted, and that young adults could manage those interpersonal frictions themselves without the university administration stepping in as a surrogate parent.
And the response to that email was explicit.
It really was.
It culminated in an effigy being placed in the courtyard, students literally screaming at her husband in the quad, and massive organized demands for their immediate resignation.
Wow.
Yeah. For Bromwich, that moment represented the absolute peak of campus conformity pressure. It was a complete visceral rejection of the idea that adults should tolerate the friction of being offended.
Interestingly, though, Bromwich is actually somewhat optimistic about the current moment.
He is. He believes the worst is actually over.
Really?
His theory is that the country had basically a nervous breakdown in 2020. You had the unprecedented isolation and fear of COVID-19 colliding directly with the murder of George Floyd and the subsequent massive Black Lives Matter protests.
Right. It created an absolute pressure cooker on college campuses.
Exactly. But he argues that post-2020, that specific pressure zone has finally begun to lift. He's seeing a bit more tolerance, a bit more breathing room. And crucially, he notes that humor is finally returning to the classrooms.
That's a relief. Which brings us to an existential question. If admissions are gamed, grades are inflated, and the culture is just now recovering from a period of intense conformity, what should these elite universities actually be doing?
Right. What is their true purpose?
Yeah. Bromwich is incredibly firm on this point. A university needs to return to its foundational mission, the creation, preservation, and transmission of knowledge, period.
And he's just as firm on what a university should not be. It shouldn't focus on quote-unquote, educating future leaders. It shouldn't act as a community, and it definitely shouldn't be a second home for students.
Wait, if a university isn't supposed to be a community or a second home, what actually binds these thousands of young people together during their 4 years? It seems like a very sterile view of college.
Well, it's not about cold facts. It's about shared purpose. He thoroughly dismantles what he calls the reflection theory of culture, the fallacy that a university is somehow obligated to mirror society's demographics or its popular attitudes.
Right.
A university has a specific, distinct purpose. He brings up John Stuart Mill here, specifically Mill's concept of the clash of ideas. True education actually requires friction. It requires surprise. You are supposed to experience being rubbed the wrong way by ideas that challenge your worldview.
You aren't paying tuition to seek harmony. You're paying to be challenged.
Exactly. And the bond isn't supposed to be forced social harmony or a manufactured feeling of being home. The bond is the shared intellectual struggle, the collective pursuit of truth.
That makes a lot of sense.
When you and your peers are all wrestling with difficult ideas, arguing, pushing each other to think harder, that creates a profoundly deep human connection.
So how do we get back to that?
Well, Bromwich has a very tactable recommendation for achieving this in the modern era, the no gizmo classroom.
Oh, banning laptops and phones.
Entirely. By removing the screens, you force genuine, unmediated discussion. You force students to look each other in the eye and actually engage with the friction of opposing thoughts in real time.
Rather than hiding behind a screen or fact-checking their peers in real time to score points.
Exactly.
The sources include this absolutely brilliant quote from a 19th century education writer that Bromwich cites, and I think it perfectly captures this lost ideal. It reads, "You go to a great school not so much for knowledge as for arts and habits, for the habit of attention, for the art of expression, for the art of assuming at a moment's notice a new intellectual position, for the art of entering quickly into another person's thoughts, for the habit of submitting to censure and refutation, for the art of indicating assent or dissent in graduated terms."
The habit of submitting to censure and refutation. That phrase is basically the thesis of his entire argument.
Right. It means you go to college to learn how to be told you're completely wrong and to survive the experience with your intellect intact. Learning how to take a hit to your ego and use it to sharpen your mind.
It's about building intellectual resilience,
Yeah.
which is a muscle that completely atrophies in an environment of 70% A's and 30 seconds of silence.
Synthesizing all of this, Bromwich's analysis leaves us with some massive open questions. Can elite universities actually implement explicit minimum SAT scores and rigorous grading curves without shattering the prestigious holistic brand they've spent decades building?
And will these new academic centers actually foster the clash of ideas or just create separate echo chambers? Reversing decades of institutional drift is just an immense challenge.
Yeah, at the beginning of this deep dive, we talked about that aura of the ivy-covered building, that promise of truth and rigor. Bromwich is arguing that universities need to stop worrying about making the inside of the building feel like a comfortable home and start worrying about rebuilding the intellectual friction that makes the foundation strong in the first place.
Because without that friction, the heavy oak doors are just protecting an illusion.
Which leaves a final provocative thought to mull over in your own life, building on that 19th century quote. If the ultimate value of a world-class education isn't the prestigious degree itself, but rather the habit of submitting to refutation and the art of assuming a new intellectual position at a moment's notice.
How can you practice that specific art in your own daily life?
Exactly. Far away from any Ivy League campus, where in your life can you actively seek out the friction of a genuinely good argument just to see if your own foundation holds?
It's a vital question, especially in a world that increasingly encourages us to just retreat into our own echo chambers.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.